Welcome to episode 57 of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. If you want to burn fat, gain energy, and enhance your health by changing when you eat, not what you eat, with no calorie counting, then this show is for you. I'm Melanie Avalon, author of What, When, Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine. And I'm here with my co-host, Jen Stevens, author of Delay, Don't Deny, Living an Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle. For more on us, check out ifpodcast.com, melanieavalon.com, and jenstevens.com. Please remember, the thoughts and opinions on this podcast do not constitute medical advice or treatment. So, pour yourself a cup of black coffee, a mug of tea, or even a glass of wine, if it's that time, and get ready for the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Okay, friends. People often ask me, what is the one supplement I cannot imagine my life without? And while there are a lot of supplements out there, a lot of ones that I love, a lot of ones that I advocate, there is one supplement that inspired me to create a whole supplement line. And that's because I take it every single day and I really can't imagine my life without it. That would be Serapeptase. And I'm about to tell you how to get up to 15% off on a special bottle version that we have that also saves you money. So Serapeptase is a proteolytic enzyme created by the Japanese silkworm. Now we make it in a lab, so it is vegan. When you take this enzyme in the fasted state, it actually goes into your bloodstream and it breaks down problematic proteins in your body. These are things that your immune system is often reacting to and that create inflammation. That's why it can do incredible, amazing things like clear your sinuses. That's why I first started taking it. You can completely say goodbye to allergy meds with Serapeptase. It reduces inflammation and pain. My friend just started taking it for her back pain and told me she was shocked at how effective it was, more so than the pain pills she normally was taking. It can help reduce cholesterol. It's even been shown in clinical studies to break down amyloid plaque in vitro and in vivo. Basically, it is a wonder supplement. And what's super cool about it is that it specifically breaks down those problematic non-living proteins. It doesn't harm healthy tissue. It actually helps protect that. That's because the function of the original enzyme in the silkworm is to break down the cocoon of the silkworm without actually harming the silkworm itself. And there aren't studies on this, but I really believe it can help catalyze your fast by enhancing the natural process of autophagy. Again, not studies on that, but from a mechanistic standpoint, it totally makes sense. Here's the thing. I was taking so many different brands of Serapeptase, and they always seemed a little hard on my stomach and have problematic ingredients in them, especially special enteric coatings where they wouldn't disclose what that was made of, which meant it probably contained problematic plastics. I knew I needed to make a change. That's why I created my Avalon X Serapeptase. It's what launched my Avalon X line. I will never stop taking it. It's one of my favorite things in my life, and the effects I experience are profound, and I hear that from all of you guys as well. We test it multiple times for purity and potency. It's free of all problematic fillers and common allergens. It comes in a glass bottle to help prevent leaching of plastics into ourselves and the environment. And we even use the minimum amount of stickiness in the label on the bottle to help reduce problematic compounds. So if you want to tackle your inflammation, clear your brain fog, oh, it's amazing for brain fog, stop your allergies, attack amyloid plaque, reduce pain, so many things, you need Serapeptase. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code Melanie Avalon. But here's another thing. We actually have a special large bottle. It's the only supplement that we have right now in a large bottle. It's the 180 version, and it saves you money. If Serapeptase is a part of your daily life, like it is mine, you definitely want our large bottle size, 180 capsules. It's the best way to save. And again, you can save even more with my Melanie Avalon 10% discount, or you can get 15% off that as well if you get a subscription, which, by the way, with a subscription, you could pause or cancel anytime after your first order. So it kind of makes sense to do a subscription because you save even more. If you want a supplement that you can actually feel the difference, I promise you, Serapeptase is the way to go. And then you might end up like me and want to give it as gifts to everybody because it's that incredible and can address so many issues. You can get this at avalonx.us. That's AVALONX.US. Again, there is the 90 capsule size and the 180 capsule size. You save more with the 180. Use the coupon code Melanie Avalon for 10% off or get a subscription for 15% off. And we will put all this information in the show notes.
One more thing before we jump in. Did you know that common ingredients found in skincare and makeup products can actually disrupt your endocrine system? These endocrine disruptors are a silent threat that can have significant impact on your health, including something that is very important to me, fertility. Your skin is your body's largest organ, and what you put on it matters. Endocrine disruptors are chemicals that interfere with the natural hormonal communication in the body. It also matters during pregnancy. And that's one of the reasons I pay close attention to what I put on my skin while being pregnant. Studies have shown that exposure to endocrine disruptors can affect both male and female fertility. For women, these disruptors can lead to irregular menstrual cycles, ovulation issues, and even polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. In men, they can reduce sperm quality and quantity, making it even more challenging to conceive. But it's not just about fertility. When it comes to fat loss, one of the reasons that endocrine disruptors can get in the way of fat loss is because a lot of our toxins are actually stored in our fat. It's a way that our bodies protect us from those toxins. These toxic compounds can even work synergistically, amplifying their harmful effects and making it that much harder to shed unwanted body fat. All of these reasons are why I am obsessed with a company called Beauty Counter. The founder actually started the company when she learned about the potential dangers of toxic chemicals and their link to health issues, specifically miscarriages and infertility. While pregnant, I make sure to only use Beauty Counter products. It's one of the only makeup lines that is officially recommended from the Environmental Working Group. What really sets Beauty Counter apart is their unwavering commitment to protecting us, the consumers, from the hidden dangers that lurk in conventional beauty products. Beauty Counter goes above and beyond, rigorously screening every single ingredient that goes into their products, ensuring that they are safe, clean, and free from harmful toxins. They're not just a beauty brand, they're a movement for change, advocating for stronger regulations in the beauty industry. With Beauty Counter, I know that I can trust that the skincare and makeup that I use are not only effective, but also safe for me and my family. They have skincare lines for every skin type, as well as so many other incredible products. I absolutely love their overnight resurfacing peel. It's my favorite way to get anti-aging benefits in a skincare product. The makeup is absolutely amazing. I have tried alternative beauty products in the past and none of them truly performed. But with Beauty Counter, the foundation is so amazing. It makes me feel like my skin can breathe and it looks so dewy and beautiful. You can shop with me at beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. New customers can use the code CLEANFORALL20 for 20% off their first order. Beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. All right, friends, now back to the show.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. This is episode number 57 of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. I'm Melanie Avalon, and I'm here with Jen Stevens.
Hi, everybody.
And I'm not just here with Jen Stevens. We have a super duper special guest that we are just so excited about today. We have Dr. Valter Longo on the podcast today. How are you, Dr. Longo?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we're thrilled to have you here. So listeners, since you're familiar with intermittent fasting, you are probably familiar with Dr. Longo, but I will tell you a little bit about him just to give you a brief overview. So Dr. Longo, he's an internationally recognized leader in the field of aging studies and related diseases. Some of his discoveries include some of the major genetic pathways that regulate aging and life-threatening diseases, as well as the identification of a genetic mutation that actually protects men from several common diseases. And he is the professor of gerontology and biological science and director of the Longevity Institute at the, wait for it, School of Gerontology at USC. I went to USC, Dr. Longo, so fight on. I agree. Likewise with you. He's also the director of the Oncology Laboratory and Longevity at the Institute of Molecular Oncology, IFOM, in Milan. He's also the founder of createcures.org, and that is a foundation which promotes scientific and medical projects aimed at the rapid identification of low-cost integrative therapies for the prevention and treatment of major diseases. He's received multiple prestigious awards on aging, And Time Magazine even called him the guru of longevity, which is a pretty nifty title, if you ask me. He also developed, and this is something that listeners might really be familiar with, it's the fasting mimicking diet, which basically, well, we're going to talk about it a lot in the podcast, but you get the benefit of fasting without actually, quote, fasting per se. So we're going to talk all about that. And he's also talked about people. He released a book in January, this past January, called The Longevity Diet, Discover the New Science Behind Stem Cell Activation and Regeneration to Slow Aging, Fight Disease, and Optimize Weight. And so that includes the fasting mimicking diet as well as his more general longevity diet. So, whew, a lot of stuff, lots to tackle, and we're excited to just jump in. So tell us a little bit about your history. How did you come to create this diet for longevity, and how did you get into the whole longevity, fasting, that whole world?
So I've been working on longevity for as long as I can remember. I was actually a sophomore in college in Texas, and I was a music student, and I sort of switched from music to longevity, essentially. And that's all I ever wanted to do. And eventually I joined the lab of Roy Walford. He was one of the pioneers of calorie restriction and also one of the leading figures in the world at UCLA for aging and longevity. And so I spent a few years with him, and then moved back to the biochemistry department at UCLA, where I started working on starvation. I mean, Walford was famous for calorie restriction, which is essentially the reduction of calorie intake by about 30% below normal. And but then in the biochemistry department, I started working with simple organisms. I mean, Walford was working mostly with humans and mice. And I went back to the simple organisms like yeast and bacteria to understand the fundamentals and identify the genes that control aging, to then move back to mice and humans.
So how did the fasting mimicking diet and longevity diet come out of that? And actually, can you tell listeners a little bit about what both of those are?
The longevity diet and the fasting mimicking diet?
Yes.
Yeah, so the longevity diet is really everything, meaning that includes the fasting mimicking diet. So the longevity diet is the title of the book. And it's really about what you eat every day. That is ideal to get you to live long and healthy, but also how do you what you can do in addition to the everyday diet to make you live long and healthy, and it's a fasting mimicking diet, which is a low protein, low sugar, high fat, high good fats, plant-based 5-day diet that should be done between once a month to couple of times a year.
And so this is the intermittent fasting podcast. So how does, I guess, particularly the fasting mimicking diet, how does that compare to intermittent fasting as far as the health benefits or the effects on the body? How do those two compare?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, intermittent fasting in the sense that you should eat for about 12 hours a day and fast for about 12 hours a day, something that I talk about in my book and I'm very much in support of. Then, of course, intermittent fasting gets to lots of different areas. So it's hard to know which one we're talking about, right? So it could be 2 hours, it could be 20 hours, it could be, you know, 2 days. The fasting mimicking diet is different from intermittent, and that's why we call it periodic fasting. Because it doesn't need to be done at any particular interval, right? So it's not something that you need to do every other week, every month. You know, you can do it if you need to do it, but that's really the important part about the FMD, the fasting mimicking diet, is it should be done when you need to do it. And now we're involving lots of doctors and registered dietitian to make that decision. Do you need to do it? Does somebody need to do it? And when and for how long? And Why is it different? Well, it's different from most intermittent fasting because it's much longer. And so, for example, if you do, let's say, the 5-2 diet, right? So that's intermittent fasting, and you have maybe 500 calories every third day. Now your fasting period is going to be maybe about 16 hours or something like that. Now the 16 hours probably gets you to move a little bit towards the ketogenic mode, but very, very little, because it takes about 2 days to be in a full ketogenic mode, right? So where the body is starting to break down fat, and mostly the fat from the visceral area, from the belly, to fuel the system, right? So so the fasting mimicking diet, because it's 5 days long, it takes advantage of that switch, and it then keeps you about 3 days in that full ketogenic mode, where your virtual entire metabolism depends on the breakdown of visceral fat.
How would that differ? I'm just personally curious, from like a ketogenic diet that a lot of people follow, where they're not even fasting per se, but they are in ketosis.
Yeah, so it's very different from a ketogenic diet, because a ketogenic diet sends a signal to the system that you have all the nourishment that you need, right? The fasting mimicking diet sends the opposite signal. It basically tells the system, I'm in a starvation mode. It's an emergency mode. Start breaking down components, both inside of a cell and at the organ level, right? So for example, autophagy can happen, but doesn't necessarily have to happen on a ketogenic diet. Lots of the cells are going to be fully functional. So this is the cellular breakdown. And also, during the fasting and fasting mimicking diet, the white blood cells start breaking down, the muscle, the liver, almost everything. And it sounds like a bad thing, but it's not, right? So I always use the analogy of a wood-burning train and say, imagine that this wood-burning train is 100 miles from its destination and is running out of fuel, out of wood to burn. And so the engineer in the train goes around the train and picks pieces of chairs and walls that are damaged and burns those, right? So now you're taking apart the train, but you're really taking the bad parts and you're burning them. Now, when you get to the next station, the train is lighter, you made it there, and you can rebuild, right? So now you take new wood and all the chairs that you've used for fuel, you can replace with the new wood. So now you have a partly regenerated, rejuvenated train.
I think that's a great analogy. I think that's one that people will really understand. I wanted to ask you to clarify something, Dr. Longo. You said you recommend the fasting mimicking diet. You called it periodic fasting. And then you said when you need to do it, like you recommend it on an as-needed basis. Can you elaborate on some of the times that you feel that it would be appropriate for people to use the fasting mimicking diet, or when they would need to use it?
Yeah, and I think this is a warning against all kinds of, you know, of course, I'm very biased with all kinds of fasting. I mean, we work very hard at getting people to do it, but I also work very hard at making sure that people don't jump ahead of the knowledge that we have, right? So you know, it is possible that after somebody does this for 10 years, the fasting mimicking diet, that we start seeing some side effects. We don't see it now. Right now, we have over 50,000 people that have done it. So the point is, although it looks great, I mean, it's safer than anything we've seen before, but you always have to keep in mind that it's possible that people will start developing some side effects. And so we're saying, if you're obese, have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high triglyceride, you probably need to do it once a month. Why? Well, because you're already at such a high risk of developing diseases because of what you have, that any minor risk that might come from doing this once a month is worth it, right? Now, if you're a very healthy person, you're a 32-year-old athlete, and you have a perfect everyday diet, now that person may not want to risk, and maybe you know, doing it once or twice a year, it's very safe, meaning that the fasting mimicking diet has got between 800 and 1100 calories per day. There is really no reason to believe that doing it once or twice a year is going to hurt anybody. So Yeah, so I think it's very important to not just say, I see an effect of whatever diet, you know, whether it's fasting mimicking diet or is every other day fasting or it's the 5-2 or it's 16 hours. I mean, all of these are really new. And I mean, people have been doing it for a long time, but it doesn't mean anything because we were not really meant to live to 100 years of age, right? So back in the days, if we made it to 55, that was already a great achievement. So now we need to go much longer, right? So then there could have been things that we did in the past that you know are not necessarily such a good idea in modern times, right? So yeah, so that's a caution to for any type of fasting. Great, it can help you tremendously if you use it well, but it may also hurt you if you misuse it.
And so what are the health benefits somebody might see from implementing the fasting mimicking diet?
Yeah, so if we start with the mice and then move to humans, so in mice we started at middle age, we took mice that are middle age, and then we started doing this twice a month until death, and basically showed that they live longer. They have about close to a 50% reduction in tumors and maybe even larger reduction in cancers, improvement in cognitive function. So they remember better. They were quicker at learning, major reduction in inflammation, and the mice, you know, eventually live longer. And in people, we've done this with 100 subjects. We did 3 cycles lasting 5 days, 3 months in a row. And at the end of the 3 cycles, we looked at many, many different things. And so they had the people at risk had lower cholesterol, lower blood pressure, lower triglycerides or fasting glucose, lower C-reactive protein, which is a marker for systemic inflammation, and also lower IGF-1, which is a potential risk factor for cancer.
Okay, so to reiterate what you just said to listeners, the fasting mimicking diet isn't something that you should just casually do or think that you can, you know, just casually do. It's something that needs to be taken very seriously, taken with the help of a practitioner, a doctor. That said, I do know that you outline in your book the specific macronutrients and the calories that are required for that. And then there's also, you have your Prolon. What is it exactly? Would you like to talk about Prolon?
Yes. Yeah. So Prolon is the fasting mimicking diet that was tested clinically and is made available by Alnutra. I should mention that I don't have any financial interest in the sense that I don't take consulting from the company, and all my shares will be donated to the foundation that I started. So it all goes back to charity, essentially.
And so that is a that's through a doctor.
Prolon is a fasting mimicking diet. The fasting mimicking diet that was tested in the clinical trial that I just mentioned is also the fasting mimicking diet that over 50,000 people have done. It doesn't have to be necessarily followed by a doctor. Because I don't have anything to do with the sale, but certainly the company recommends that a doctor follows anybody that has a disease. But if somebody's healthy, and then a registered dietitian can just give them some instructions on how to do it, and they can do it at home. And so far, it's been extremely safe. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Hi, friends. Now, if you're anything like me, you love biohacking, intermittent fasting, and getting feedback and data on what our bodies are doing. Now, when we do intermittent fasting or extended or prolonged fasting, it's hard to get feedback sometimes on how our bodies are doing in terms of fat burning and ketosis. This is one of the reasons that I created the Tone device, which is a breath ketone analyzer. It can tell you the rate of fat burning your body is in by detecting the ketones on your breath. If you practice intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating, do an occasional 24-hour fast like once a week, or prolonged or extended fasting, it's likely your body is getting into light ketosis. If you are doing keto or low-carb, even sometimes paleo, you may be getting into a deeper state of fat burning and ketosis. If you do a high-carb diet, then you probably get into a light state of ketosis after some fasting. What I love about the Tone is that you can simply breathe into it for about 4 to 5 seconds, and it will give you instant feedback on the rate of fat burning that your body is at. Now, when we are in ketosis, our bodies are at their highest rate of fat burning, which is what is so neat. We actually breathe out our fat. So the carbons that we are measuring with the Tone device are actually coming from our fat. When we practice different approaches like intermittent fasting or doing time-restricted eating, lower carb diets or keto approaches, our bodies actually make a metabolic switch where fat becomes our primary fuel. And the body takes fat and converts it into ketones in the liver. About 15 to 20% of those circulating ketones are then diffused through our lungs out in our breath. And it is so amazing. I absolutely love using the Tone every single day. I love the biofeedback, especially when I am doing any kind of fasting, and I can see my body gradually get into a deeper and deeper state of fat burning through those ketone levels going higher and higher. Now, one of the reasons I created the Tone is because testing blood ketones is cost prohibitive. The test strips are extremely expensive. They are wasteful. You no longer have to buy test strips anymore. You can just breathe into the Tone device for 4 to 5 seconds and get that instant feedback. It's a one-time investment, and you'll be able to test an unlimited amount of times. Now, I always recommend testing with the Tone device fasted first thing in the morning and testing up until you have your first meal of the day, and you will be able to see differences there, especially if you do a longer fast. You'll see the ketones go higher and higher, and it really is so great to get that biofeedback. Now, for the past year and a half, I've been working on a brand new version of the Tone, the second generation Tone device, and I am so excited for it to soon be available to you all. I wanted to create a special launch discount for the Tone device so that any of you who are interested can take advantage of that discount. I've never discounted the Tone device before, but if you are signed up to the exclusive VIP list, you will receive that launch discount. To sign up for the list, you can go to tonedevice.com and enter your name and email address, and you will receive an email which you can confirm to double opt in, and you'll be the first to know when the new second generation Tone device is available to order, and you will also receive that exclusive launch discount. I am so excited for you all to try it, so be sure to go and sign up at tonedevice.com. All right, now back to our show.
So for listeners, if you go to ifpodcast.com/episode57, we'll put links to all of this information that we're talking about so you can look more into that if that's something that's of interest to you. So Dr. Longo, so how do you feel? And this is kind of funny. I know a lot of people they try, like I said, their own versions of the fasting mimicking diet. And I'm laughing because I actually wrote an entire blog post about it when I first heard about it. And I did discuss in that blog post about making my quote own version. Is that something that that worries you, or do you think people are mostly going to benefit from that? Or how do you feel about that? I mean, I know in your book you do outline how to do it with, like I said, with real whole foods. So how do you feel about where it's going?
I mean, I didn't want to in the book hide what it is. You know, I just wanted people to know that it's there. But in fact, what we tested clinically is more complicated than that. I mean, it'd be hard for most people to make it. And I think what I saw in Europe when I had the first version of the book, they basically gave an option. Say you can do it with the kit that you buy, or you can do it find a registered dietitian and they can help you do it. And then we started getting the complaints back from the doctors, from the clinics, and basically lots of people ended up improvising in lots of different ways. And, you know, a percentage of them got hurt. You know, they got hurt because they didn't know that they couldn't exercise with it, or they got hurt because they just responded with hypoglycemia to the fasting mimicking diet that was improvised, and or hypotension, or et cetera, et cetera. So I know that people just have this need to say, I wanted to be free, I wanted to just be able to control it. And unfortunately, although I fight with my own company to make the price as low as possible, I also understand there is a safety and efficacy come first. And so I really have to move away. And I know some people are going to be disappointed. They're going to say, oh, you know, now I have to go buy a product. But I really think that is the right thing to do for safety, for efficacy. I'll just give you an example. When we start talking to the FDA, or start looking in the FDA regulations for talking to the FDA consultants, and we have olives in the prolonged kit, and they say probably you're gonna have to get rid of the olives, and I say why? Because the FDA will not allow an olive to be included because it cannot be quantified. Right? So I mean, yeah, but see, you know, to us it might sound funny. But this is the agency that regulates drugs, and they've been doing it for a long time, and their purpose is to protect people. Now, you could say, what difference could it possibly make? Well, it could make a big difference. You know, I remember when we were first doing cancer clinical trials, we were arguing, and there was a lot of doctors involved. We were arguing whether a few grams of sugar that it was coating supplements could completely wipe out the effect of the fasting, right? We didn't know. I mean, then we learned that probably not. But so I think that's the point of the FDA, that if you have to be able to replicate it exactly the way it was. And I'm not saying that, you know, if you did a water-only fasting, you could have lots of good effects by doing a water-only fasting. But you could also get hurt. You know, for example, gallstone formation could be promoted by a water-only fasting, as well as hypotension, et cetera. So I know it's hard to see it, but there's lots of problems that can come from improvisation, and this is why we have pharmacists, we have doctors, we have the FDA. Otherwise, we'll have gotten rid of it a long time ago.
Well, I think that is a great way of explaining that, because you're right, we're like an olive. But you want to make sure that it's safe, and that that it's been tested the way that everybody's using it. That makes sense. Can I switch gears and ask a question? Would you explain the word juventology? I read that in your book and I just loved it.
Yeah, so I guess the point, I'm in a school of gerontology here at USC. And in fact, just the other day, I presented, and the president of the university was president. I said, I really don't like this name that we have, you know. And I really like much more juventology, which is the science of staying young, right? So I was never that interested in what is the process of why people get old. I was much more interested in what is the process that keeps somebody young for 40, 50 years, right? And then what happens to that program that was so perfect up to that date? So that's juventology. That's the study of the program that maintains organisms young.
Yeah, I think that's a great way just to shift it, because you're right. That's what we want. We want to stay young and youthful as long as we can, and that's the whole point of this. Could you also talk about some of the things you mentioned in your book about eating foods from your ancestry and how that makes a difference for us?
Yes. So if you look around now, almost every month there is a new food, right? That comes from somewhere around the world, and it's got all these beneficial effects, and everybody gets excited about, you know, whether it's curcumin or it's quinoa, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the problem with that is that we're focusing on, let's say, protein content. Like quinoa has lots of proteins, and so people may get it for that reason. The problem is that you're now bringing in something that your immune system has never seen before. And also not just the immune system, it's also a matter of like your gut, your bacteria in your gut, the microbiota has never seen that food before. And neither did your parents, right? So of course that could have a neutral effect or no effect, it could be beneficial, but now you're putting yourself at risk for an autoimmunity, an allergy. For example, Southern Italians are lactose intolerant. Norwegians are almost 100% lactose tolerant, right? So now imagine that an Italian starts eating milk, which was in the past only used by adults in the Northern European countries. Of course, you get all kinds of problems, right? You wouldn't know, I mean, say 100 years ago, people wouldn't know why they were sick. Now we know it's lactose intolerant, right? So my point is that this happens with all kinds of foods that come from somewhere else. The best way to go is, identify the range of foods that are actually nourishing you from your own land, essentially, right? And from your own ancestors' lands, and just stay with those. You know, that is by far whether it's Okinawa or Loma Linda, California, or Sardinia, Italy, or Calabria, Italy, or Greece. All these areas that have record longevity, that's what they do. They never go, if you ask the centenarians, they rarely tell you, oh yeah, I used to eat all these exotic foods from all over the world.
That's right. And you just mentioned some of the blue zones that are around the world. That's also something that's I've been fascinated by. Can you talk about the blue zones a little bit and what commonalities you found between them?
Yeah, so the book tries to learn from these longevity, record longevity zones, the blue zones, and not just the blue zones, all other areas that have record longevity. But that forms one pillar of the five pillars that I use in the book, meaning that we look at the science, and science includes animal studies, includes epidemiological studies, includes clinical work, and then it combines it with the blue zones to come up with the solutions. And not surprisingly, all the blue zones have in common this diet that is vegan plus a little bit of either fish or meat, maybe once a week. That's what most people used to do in most of these areas. Mm-hmm. And it's because it is a low meat diet, the proteins are also low. And it turns out in a study that we did a few years ago that the low protein intake was associated with protection from cancer and protection from overall mortality. So these areas have in common also the eating from the ancestors and being well nourished. They tend to get everything they need from their diet. And they're pretty careful at picking all the right things. Also, because I think some of these has been passed down from person to person in the family, making sure that your children eat all the right food. And I think now we're starting to lose a little bit what we learn from ancestors, because we move around so much, and we sort of need a manual. When in the old days. It sort of came with when you grew up, you got careful recommendations.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We've lost track of what our ancestors did eat. I bet a lot of people wouldn't know. They would have to do some research to figure it out.
Yeah, probably most people wouldn't know. And exactly that. Yeah, you're right. They will need to do research. Maybe ask the parents, what did you grow up? Because, of course, you wouldn't have to get to your grandparents. You just have to. Your parents, what did you eat when you were growing up? Most people will tell you, they remember those are probably some of their favorite foods. Yeah.
And also, I wonder how far back you should go, because, for example, my family is mostly from the British Isles, but on both my mother's side and my father's side, they came to America in like the 1600s, 1700s. So how far back should we go? Should we go all the way back to the British Isles when we're looking for our ancestral diet?
No, you don't need to go back. You just need to go to your parents and grandparents and, of course, ask questions. And if they were fine with lots of the foods that they ate, then you could just maybe look for the common denominator with some of the foods that come from the UK region, and you'll be fine. I mean, I don't think that if your parents and grandparents for 100 years ate the same food and nothing ever happened to them, then you're probably okay. But so for example, if your parents and grandparents drank milk as adults, the chances that you're now genetically lactose intolerant is relatively small. Now you could be, and you have to pay attention, but that's unlikely.
That's good to know.
And so going back to the autoimmunity and the food reactions and such, so I know a lot of listeners write into us because they have digestive problems or they just really struggle with certain foods. And I'm bringing this up because I as well struggle a lot with IBS and food reactions and find that I actually do better on a lower FODMAP type approach to diet. So can that approach still be done with your like longevity diet? So for people who seem to not react so well to lots of plant matter in their diet.
Yes, I think that what happens is that we're mixing conditions which are, somewhat pathological with the diet that you do after you solve the pathology, right? So, if somebody has inflammatory bowel disease or similar intestinal issues, I think the key is to fix the problem. Then I think for the great majority of the people, once you fix the problem, you can go back to the lots of these foods that don't necessarily that bother you right now. I'm one of them, right? For example. And I've gone through, I had an appendectomy last year and, antibiotics with it. And after I started having the problems with all kinds of foods that normally I could eat, right? So then I very carefully took my time to get back to where I was. And now it took me about a year and now I'm back, right? So, and why is this important? Well, the microbiota in your gut, right? They may go back a couple of generations, right? So this is really remarkable. And with all the antibiotics now we take, and especially if you have surgery like I did or something like that, you can really have to start from scratch. And then it's going to take potentially a couple of years to rebuild that, right? So like in your case, most likely, like in the case of almost everybody out there having this problem, it's a matter of rebuilding. And rebuilding sometimes also takes some of the things that bother you, just a little bit of it, and takes a lot of patience, a lot of testing. So I think that, these diets were really so common among the world population that it is extremely unlikely that they have some intrinsic problems, right? But it's very likely that, like tomatoes, for example, is pro-inflammatory, fine, but it's one of the most eaten foods in the world, and the great majority of people don't have a problem with tomatoes, right? So the question is, if somebody is bothered by tomatoes, is this a permanent problem, or is this something that the gut microbiota can get reused to? Now you have bacteria that can process the lactins, et cetera, in the tomatoes, and then at that point you go back to normal. So that, it's more than can be done in an interview like this. So it takes like a very good doctor to recognize that that's got to be fixed, and it can be very tricky, And the FODMAP, I think it's okay, but it's probably not the best way to go. It's much better to, identify the pro-inflammatory foods and fix the microbiota, and then eventually go back to the foods, excluding the ones that, let's say, if you have celiac disease and you're gluten intolerant, then of course, if that's an autoimmunity, then of course you have to get rid of gluten. You can't just go back to it. But even gluten, it is possible that somebody could be retrained to the immune system could be retrained to tolerate low doses of it.
Yeah, that approach is pretty similar to what I've seen in my journey. My problem started, I got about a food poisoning and then antibiotics from that, and everything just kind of crumbled. But I've learned so much from it. And the approach that I've seen is very similar to what you're talking about as far as fixing the problem. And that might require restricting certain foods at the beginning, but then ultimately nourishing the gut microbiome and hopefully getting back to a place where you can tolerate more foods. But then I do wonder, so for people who do find themselves thriving on a higher protein, lower carb diet, would you still recommend that they switch over or try to, embrace the principles that are more in line with your longevity diet, which is lower in protein?
Well, I mean, yes, because, the low carb, high protein diet has been associated over and over with increased mortality, increased diseases. None of the record longevity population have a high protein diet. And now I think that people are confusing a high starch, high sugar diet with a high carbohydrate diet. And that's a very, very important distinction. So absolutely, it, for people, and I see it in Italy, I see all over the world, lots of people move to a high pasta, bread, rice diet, where you have these big dishes. And of course, the United States is very much doing the same. And so if you have lots of sugars and lots of starches, you're going to have a problem, no doubt about it. But the idea of removing carbs as the major source of energy is also as bad, right? Meaning that, the most successful population have a high carbohydrate diet, but they have a high carbohydrate diet that is in the form of legumes, it's in the form of vegetables, and in the form of cereals, right? So I think that is the ideal diet to have. Now, if you care for, if you go through that process like I did for the past year, and you can't get out of it, yeah, then I can see in some cases somebody might say, I'd rather, adopt a diet that may make me live a little bit shorter, but it allow me to have a normal life. Then I think that's a compromise that somebody might have to make. So if somebody ate steaks 4 times a week, and that's the only possible way is that they can avoid inflammation. I doubt that that's true, but I mean, I think it's possible that for some people with certain genetic background, let's say a high meat diet may somehow allow them to have a normal life, whereas the other ones may not.
I think that's a great point because everybody's coming from a different place. I did want to ask, you mentioned that you could rebuild like you did after your surgery. Can you give some tips for how to do that, to do the rebuilding so that you can add some of these foods back in if you're having problems with them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the rebuilding, a good way to do it is to start simple, right? So start with the things that you know don't bother you. And make them very frequent in your diet. So it could be 10 foods. Say these 10 foods, I eat them, I'm fine. And then slowly start adding one at a time, right? So for example, if tomatoes used to bother you, this could be a good thing to start introducing once in a while. And just keep it the 10 foods that you know don't bother you plus tomato. And go 1 week like that. If at the end of the week, your problem starts again, then tomato is going to have to be excluded, right? And then you go to the next one. I mean, it takes a long time, but it's definitely worth it because I think, slowly, if you're bothered a little bit, that's okay. Keep going with a little bit of tomato because that might be stimulating a particular population of the bacteria to start growing using the fiber from the tomato. And then the tomato, all of a sudden, a couple of weeks later, let's say legumes, right? This is very typical. People may say, hey, if I eat chickpeas or if I eat beans, I have all these kinds of problems. Well, lots of times, that's just the first 15 days, 30 days, right? Then the system gets used to it. You develop the new bacteria, and that's not a problem anymore. So it's tricky, But yeah, that's what I suggest. Keep it basic, then add to it and be very patient. And then you see that after, it might take the whole process, it might be 2 years long, but that's definitely worth it. Because then you go back to a strong microbiota.
Thank you.
Do you recommend supplementing or experimenting with different probiotic strains, or do you think that it's better to cultivate that through dietary choices?
Both, meaning that I think that once you have the problem, the probiotic and the prebiotic may be very good, right? So once you have an inflammation, and that's a little bit, it's a pathology or close to it, then I think the probiotic are really important, because you have probably a very disrupted microbiota, and just giving the food may be very difficult for that process to occur. Eventually, as you move to a less inflamed state, then I think we need to get rid of the probiotic and move back to the food. You know, let it rebuild like our grandparents had it. They never had problems. So probiotic is basically taking over something that the gut has always done on its own and imposing, right? So it could go well, it could go not well eventually. So that's why I don't like the probiotic all the time. But I think it's a good idea once you have a massive acute problem, because that's when you have to intervene fast, you know. And of course, you can have medicine, but that's probably even a worse idea. But the probiotic in that moment represents the cavalry bringing in the good guys and at least helping reduce the inflammation so that you can move to a better state.
Gotcha. And then you mentioned like the grandparents not having problems. So what do you think is the key reason that we are seeing so many degenerative diseases today? Do you think it goes back to the antibiotics like you were talking about, or the processed foods, or everything? Do you think there's a common cause, or is it just a conglomerate of the perfect storm?
I think it could be any of the above and all of the above, meaning there could be definitely the antibiotics, massive antibiotics, multiple antibiotics that now are given and just completely destroying almost everything in their track. And then the toxins, it could be the pesticides from the fruits and vegetables. It could be, of course, the sweeteners and lots of the things that somebody might have introduced and our grandparents didn't have, right? So they didn't have Diet Coke every day, and they didn't have candy every day. And now that doesn't mean that, I think some of it could be fine to some people, but when you start introducing antibiotic, pesticides, candy, Diet Coke, you know, aspartame, yes, one of it is bound to start pushing the microbiota in the wrong direction, and then you build from there. You know, and then things get, you know, inflammation in the gut can lead to more changes in the composition of the microbiota. And then it's a lost battle after that, because unless you do what I was saying, you have to go to a very fundamental diet and start rebuilding.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It really is just the snowball effect of everything that's going on, and it's hard to pinpoint it, and it's not just one thing. It's all of them working together, I think.
Can I ask this is a very selfish question. I just am really curious about your thoughts on it. How do you think that mindset and everything plays into all of this? Like, do you think it's all just about the foods that we eat and how our immune system reacts and everything, or is there a mental component to it as well? Does that even affect the immune system? Because we talk about that a lot in the podcast, and I'm sort of obsessed with it. So I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've known for a long time about the placebo effects, and so we know that that somebody can be given a sugar pill and they could do much, much better than somebody that didn't get that sugar pill. So that means that the mind can have tremendous effects on all kinds of processes and release of hormones and factors And yeah, of course, these changes that are mind regulated can have big impacts on everything. So yeah, so absolutely, that the way you respond to a problem can make a big difference in whether you're gonna have a success. I mean, at the mind level, it can make a big difference on whether you're gonna have success or failure.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that too.
That's great to hear.
I know. Yeah.
Yay. All right. And I guess we should clarify, because both Jen and I have read your book, by the way, and I loved it. It was fantastic. But I guess we should actually clarify. I don't think we've talked about what your longevity diet actually looks like specifically. So what would that look like for listeners?
Yeah, so the longevity diet, having run a lot of clinical trials, and I also am aware of and work with lots of people. I'm aware of compliance issues, meaning that if you tell somebody to revolutionize their diet, even if they do it, it's going to be for 6 months to a year. Then they're going to drop it. Then they're going to have more problems than before. So, for example, the longevity diet includes pasta or rice or bread, right? But just enough to please people and to make sure that they're going to enjoy. So, for example, I'm from Italy. If you, I refuse the big dish of pasta, right? You know, I mean, whenever I go to Italy, it's everywhere, and I say, this is crazy. It doesn't make any sense. At the same time, I refuse the complete removal of the pasta from my dish. So I like to see about 50 grams, you know, let's say a couple of ounces of pasta, and then, you know, 300 grams of chickpeas and 200 grams of mixed vegetables. To me, that's the ideal dish, right? Because it mentally, it's very rewarding, and lots of olive oil on top of it, right? So in each, I think, area of the world has got its own version of it. Maybe Japan has a little bit less fats, olive oil, etc. But most of other areas tend to have a very similar version of it. So, yeah, so I think that's an ideal, that's a good example of what the ideal diet should be. And it should really be about eating a lot, right? The dish that I just described is 1 pound, over 1 pound in weight, right? So that's a lots of food. And by the end of it, you won't be able to eat much more than that. And yet, and so high nourishment, you got all the vitamins and minerals that you need. Your stomach is full, so that the signals given to the brain are of fullness. And proteins are going to be low, because it's almost impossible to have a high protein diet that is plant-based. So you're going to almost eat as much as you want, and you only have to worry about protein intake, because it would be almost impossible to overeat proteins by doing this. So I think that's a good example of the longevity diet. And then, of course, I have fish a couple times a week. Why is that? Because I think it's easy to go in the other direction, which is become malnourished, become omega-3 malnourished, become protein deficient. You know, so many people that I talk to, and they're, let's say, vegan, I ask them, well, what did you eat in the last 3 days? And I would say in a good 50% of the time, they haven't had enough protein, or even near enough protein. You know? So they might say, I've had a salad with some chickpeas on it, and maybe they had 30 grams of chickpeas. That's 3 grams of protein, right? So if you eat like that, it's just a matter of a couple of years, you're going to be in trouble. Your immune system is going to start shutting down, and most of your function is going to start being not as effective. And so I think it's fish a couple times a week prevents these problems by, you know, giving the omega-3, in most cases, much more protein. Now you may have, you know, your typical fish meal may have at least 70 or 80 grams of protein. And so that makes sure that even if on the other 5 days you ate poorly, that's gonna get rid of the problem.
So the key is really to have lower protein, but not too low. You have to make sure it's still sufficient.
Yes. Yeah. So you have to have a law, but exactly, not too low. Yeah, no, and I think so many people don't realize when they make the decision they're going to go on a vegan diet, low protein diet, they don't realize that the too low is as bad as too high.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Can you talk about the five pillars of longevity? I know we've mentioned them a little bit and hinted about them, but what are the five pillars of longevity that you have come up with?
Yeah, so the first one we already discussed is the centenarians and the record longevity areas of the world. That's a very important pillar. Why is that? Well, let's say that you come up with, let's say, the ketogenic diet. Right? You could say, the ketogenic diet, I've looked at clinical trials, it looks good, and I've looked at animal studies, and there's so studies that are showing that ketogenic diet is good for animals. But then you go look around the record longevity population around the world, and you'll see that none of them have a ketogenic diet. So that doesn't mean that the ketogenic diet could not turn out to be good, right? It's just that it's very risky, right? Because now you don't have that pillar telling you, look, people have been doing something like this for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they made it to, they had very long lives. So I really think it's one of the most important pillars. And then, of course, you know, epidemiology is very important. Another pillar, you know, if you, for example, we work with the Harvard School of Public Health, and they have 120,000 people that they follow. It's called the nurse and doctor study, where, you know, they've been following what they eat and what diseases they develop, and for decades, right? So they can compare people with different diets and see what different diseases and also overall mortality. They live longer if they have a certain diet versus another one. And then clinical trials, you know, clinical trials are very important. Well, what if you take, once you have an hypothesis, you take people that, let's say, on a high protein diet and people on a low protein diet, and you compare how they do. And those are harder to do because they're very expensive. You know, for example, olive oil, right? That's a good example of something that has been tested by large, several thousand people, randomized clinical trials, where a group was placed on lots of olive oil and nuts every day, and another group was placed on a low-fat diet, and they had to stop the study within 5 years because the people on the low-fat diet were doing so much more poorly than the people on the lots of olive oil that it was unethical to continue, right?
Is that the PREDIMED study? Is that how you say that one?
This is the ESTRUC study in Barcelona. Yeah, so, and that was continued then to also show effects on cognitive decline, you know, so the people using lots of olive oil and nuts, they were doing better cognitively in the long run. And then the fourth pillar is animal studies, but animal studies focus on longevity. So if you give a particular diet to mice, can they have, let's say, less cancer or whatever, but can they also live longer and healthier, right? That's very important because, again, you could have temporary effects for any diet. They look very good, you know. So, for example, if you give mice a high protein, low-carb diet, they eat less and they lose weight, right? So you if you did that in mice, you conclude after a couple months that that's a good diet. And then you keep going and you'll see that they die earlier and they start developing metabolic disorders, right? So if you give mice a high-carb, low-protein diet, they eat more, they start gaining a little bit of weight, but then they have less metabolic disorders and they live longer. That's another, I think, good example of how basic research focused on longevity can help you, not alone, but together with the other pillars, come up with the recommendations that are not going to change anytime soon. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I do know you discuss in your book about how we should have a lower protein intake up to a certain age. And then was it around 65, I think you said, that higher protein is better. So why is there that shift? Like why do we need more protein when we're older?
Yes. We don't know for sure, but certainly one thing that we saw in the trial is that IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor 1, declines with age. And so people that had high protein diet before the age of 65 had very different levels of IGF-1 compared to people that had the low protein diet. But after 65, that didn't make any difference, right? So people that had a high protein diet had lower levels of IGF-1 than younger people that had a low protein diet, right? So meaning that probably the aging process is causing such severe deficiencies and problems that by introducing another deficiency, which is low protein, you make the system struggle even more, right? For example, we show that if you take mice that are young and you give it a very low protein diet, they're fine. If you give mice that are old and you give them very low protein diet, they start losing weight very rapidly. So, for example, it could be the absorption in the gut. It's affected. An old individual may not be able to absorb as much. It could be integration into the muscle mass. The amino acids are there, but the system is not able to build as well anymore, right? So these are just some of the examples of the things that that could be problematic when you have a restriction in all people, and not surprisingly, lots of studies are now showing that having a little bit of extra weight, which hurts you when you're younger, it may help you when you're very old.
And then you have the the outliers, like you discussed in your book, and then that we just read about, the centenarians who basically eat whatever they want, and here they are at 100. Just chipping away. So,
yeah, that is, usually that is explained by genetics, right? So, for example, Emma Morano, that I followed until she died last year at 117, she was the oldest person in the world. And, so journalists talked a lot about the fact that she ate 3 eggs a day and that she had meat every day. They didn't talk about the fact that she didn't have all that meat when she was up to age 85, 90, right? She actually had a much better diet. And they also didn't talk about the fact that she had 7 brothers and sisters, and also the parents, almost everybody, or either everybody or everybody but one, lived past the age of 90. So that means that this is a very lucky and rare group of people that had such a genetic makeup that doesn't matter what they eat. Everybody else, though, is not in that group, And that's interesting. I always think it's interesting because everybody else wants to be in that group, and they say, well, if she made it to 117 eating meat, then maybe I can. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that.
And then they all start eating 3 eggs a day and all trying to do exactly what she did, right?
Yeah, I think these articles do tremendous damage, and because people are just waiting to do this,
Yeah, I think people are so quick to just try to mimic. They see something successful in a population or a study or some certain person even, and they're so quick to mimic it because they think, oh, well, that clearly works. But it's more about what works for you personally. That's what we talk about a lot on the podcast, finding what supports your health and your microbiome and your state of being. So it's very individual.
Well, it's individual, but also don't forget that there are some rules that really apply. In fact, we've been focusing on showing similarities between microorganisms, mice, and humans, right? So there are some fundamentals that apply to a unicellular organism as much as humans, So I think it's important to look at the personalization, but also look at fundamentals and what's something fundamentally making you live longer. For example, periodic fasting, right? You can do it in a yeast, you can do it in a mouse, and you can do it in people, and it makes all of them live longer. That's very important because there are some things that are just as old as the life on Earth.
So if you were to give us 3 fundamental principles that we could do to support our health and longevity, what would those be?
Well, for sure, doing a fasting mimicking diet enough times, you know, based on your needs, that's probably a number one. And number two would be have a pescatarian diet, a low mercury pescatarian diet. So eat fish a couple of times a week and then lots of legumes and vegetables. I mean, with the exception of people that are bothered by that particular diet, at least, you know, either temporarily or long term. And then I would say probably eat, if you're overweight, eat two meals a day. Forget this 5 meals a day thing. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you're supporters of this bad idea, but it's a bad idea.
No, we're not.
Yeah, we're not. We're not fans.
You're not clear who came up with that one, but it undoubtedly help us in the United States get to 72% of the population being overweight and obese. It also undoubtedly help getting people to eat for 15, 16 hours a day. None of this happened before. And when you're told eat 5 or 6 times a day, I mean, this is what happens. You overeat and you eat for longer periods than you used to before.
Yeah, it's funny. I've recently been trying to gain a little weight, and I've been thinking maybe I should just do exactly everything they tell us to do, like eat constantly throughout the day, eat lots of snacks, eat low fat, and then maybe I'll probably gain weight.
That's for sure. And in fact, you know, that's what we recommend for people that need to gain weight. We say, yeah, eat more times a day, and don't be as careful with the selection of foods, because otherwise it's hard to gain weight. Yeah.
Right.
It's ironic. So out of curiosity, what is your typical diet? What have you eaten today? And what do you typically eat?
Well, today I skip lunch because I've gained a few pounds. And so you know, I use my own technique, you know, of going from 3 meals a day to 2 meals a day whenever I had to get things back in check. I've been doing it for 20 years. It works very well. And I, for breakfast, I had tea. I usually have a black tea and green tea together with half a lemon. And the reason I have the black tea is because it covers the taste of the green tea.
I was going to ask. That's funny.
Yeah. Because then it tastes just like black tea. And, you know, and then tonight, I don't know, but probably I often have what I described earlier, which is the 50 grams of pasta and the 300 grams of legumes like beans or garbanzo beans or black beans, etc. And then you know, maybe a couple hundred grams of vegetable, mixed vegetable. That's a very typical, or let's say broccoli or you know, one of the variations. Sometimes I have salmon with salad, but in general, I always also look for things that I like. I truly like, you know. I don't eat almost anything that I don't truly like. That's also important to find the 20 things that you look for. For example, once a week I have a pizza without cheese and with like 8 different ingredients on it. The pizza place calls it the crazy pizza, but it's actually taking something that could be unhealthy and making it fairly healthy. Now the pizza, it's with shrimp, and so it's a high nourishment meal versus what I would have if it was covered with cheese, which is lots of animal fat, etc. And animal proteins, which I exclude from the diet.
There's so many questions I want to ask you still. I wish we could have like a 5-hour podcast. I would ask so many questions. But do you have any final questions, Jen, before I wrap things up?
No, I think we hit all the highlights, and I've really enjoyed talking to you, Dr. Longo. This has been wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yes, this has been such an honor, and it's actually very surreal for me. I just remember when I was at USC, I would always bike by the gerontology school, and it looked so mysterious. I was like, oh, I wonder what they study in there.
We have people that are 500 years old in the school.
Oh my goodness.
That's the little known secret now we've told the world.
That's awesome. And then even when I was writing my book, because I released a book in January, What, When, Wine, and I would study all of your studies and everything that you wrote. So just having you on the podcast today has just been really, really wonderful. And it's been great to pick your brain, and we really appreciate your time. And I think listeners have definitely learned a lot from our discussion.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you very much. Very, very good questions.
Wonderful. So for listeners, a few things before we go. If you go to ifpodcast.com/episode57, that's where I'm going to put links to everything that we discussed, all the show notes, everything will be there. And then we'll put links to your book as well. Dr. Longo, how can people best follow you? I mean, I know they can get your book, but where is that available? How can people follow you as far as social media goes? If they have questions, what are all the things?
So the book, of course, is on Amazon. It's should be still at Barnes and Nobles and the other bookstores. And then people usually follow me at Prof. Walter Longo, P-R-O-F, Walter Longo, Facebook page. And we post every few days, we post different articles and that we feel that are sort of filtered for quality and they're published in very good journals and they can help people mostly in the domain of food and longevity.
Wonderful. So I will put links to all of that at ifpodcast.com/episode57. And then a few of the last things for listeners before we go. If you're in iTunes, you can subscribe to our podcast and then you will get episodes downloaded automatically each and every week. You won't even have to do anything. And while you're in iTunes, if you'd like to write a brief review, that would mean the absolute world. You can also follow us on Instagram. Our handle is Our handle is IF Podcast. And yeah, so I think that's all the things. Any final thoughts from anybody before we go? I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Now, I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. I think it was something our audience will really like to hear.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Great.
All right. Perfect. Well, enjoy the rest of your evening.
Okay. See ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Please remember, the opinions we discussed on this show do not constitute medical advice. We're not doctors. Check out ifpodcast.com for more information on us. Theme music was composed by Leland Cox. See you next week.